This is our last episode of our three-part coverage of SVP, and I talked to Dr. Chris Bell from the University of Texas, Austin, and he told me a bit about the history of the society. I'm here talking to Dr. Christopher Bell, the professor at the University of Texas at Austin. And I think it's also safe to say that you're also a historian. So you're in charge of the SVP archives, and you have put together this incredible exhibit talking about the last 75 years in honor of the 75th anniversary of Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. So can you tell me what you've done here?
Absolutely. First, I should clarify that this was the work of a committee of three. The Society has an archive committee that is responsible for maintaining materials prior to putting them in the official Society archive, which is housed at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And the committee is a three-person committee right now because our initial charge was to review all the materials that exist in the archive and make a determination of what's there and also what's not there so that we can identify things that we need to find to put in the archive. And in honor of our 75th anniversary meeting, Stephen Cohen, Lou Taylor, and I all put together this material that you're able to see if you were at the meeting. But because you're in a podcast world, you can't see it. So I'm going to tell you what we did. And it essentially involves three separate projects that were related and presented separately here at the meeting. One is an exhibit in visual format of 5 15-foot long banners that discuss various aspects of the history of the society and its activities. And a second was a flip book of pictures of paleontologists who have died, who received obituary coverage in the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology News Bulletin. We provided the photograph, and then behind it was a copy of the obituary from the News Bulletin. And this was done so that young paleontologists could introduce themselves visually to people who they can no longer meet, but whose names they're familiar with from reading the literature, I hope.
Yes.
And familiarizing themselves with the history of the paleontology through publications, and then they can put faces with names, and if they recognize a name but don't really know what that person did beyond the one paper they've read, they could read a little bit about their history and where they worked and what they did and learn a little bit about the past. And then the third project was an effort to document the history of the development of the logo of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, which has its own interesting history. And we did a poster presentation and also a display case in a museum about the formation of the logo. And accompanying that was another display case that dealt with a visual representation of some of the publications of the Society and various pieces of ephemerata from meetings in the past. So we had a collection of all the pins that the memorial pins, or whatever they call them, lapel pins. That's it. So anyway, we did that. And I'll walk you through the poster exhibit and tell you in oral form what we tried to communicate in a very visual form here at the meeting. And we started simply with a discussion about the origins of the Society. And we actually did that in cartoon format. But the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology has an interesting history that really goes back to the early 1900s. And in 1901, there was a group of vertebrate paleontologists in the United States who formed the American Society of Vertebrate Paleontologists. And that society was only around from 1901 to 1908. And in 1908, they merged with a group of wildly independent freeform invertebrate paleontologists, and they formed a new group called the Paleontological Society. And that group was affiliated with the Geological Society of America, whose roots go back into the late 1800s and 1888. And the SVP then didn't exist. There was a section of paleontology The SVP actually didn't exist at that time. There was a group within the Paleontological Society. Vertebrate paleontologists eventually found themselves in a relative minority, and they didn't really have an opportunity to discuss their papers with people who knew or cared what they were doing. And so they formed an independent section of the Paleontological Society in 1934. And the vertebrate section of the Paleo Society lasted until 1940. And at that time, they put a call out to the membership of that section and mailed it in June of 1940 and asked people to decide whether they would want to form a separate society around vertebrate paleontology exclusively. And the decision was to do that. And so there was an organizational meeting held in December of 1940 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And a group of people met and decided to form the society. And their first annual meeting was held in December of 1941. And the society then had just organized itself. They formed a constitution. They wrote a constitution, and we had 229 signatories on that constitution. 37 of them were gathered at the associated with the initial meeting of the group, and then they allowed additional signatures to be added to the constitution until the close of the first annual meeting. And there were 192 people who added signatures to the initial 37 before the end of the 1941 first annual meeting. And of those 192, 151 were actually signed in proxy by George Gaylord Simpson. And so on the Constitution, their names are written on the Constitution in his hand with a little GGS written next to them to indicate that he's the one who's actually the signatory responsible for putting them on there. And then they closed the signatures for charter members of the society. So we have a copy, we brought a copy, a digital copy of the Constitution with the signature pages for people to look at, because people like looking at old names and signatures. And it's interesting, we emphasized here also women have become increasingly prominent in the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology through the years. And at the initial organizational meeting in 1940, there was only a single woman present. Her name was Tilly Edinger. And she was a German, and a German Jew, who had escaped, managed to get out of Germany, and arrived in the United States at the invitation of Al Roemer just before the war broke out for the United States. And she was the only woman present at our organizational meeting, and she went on to be very active in the society. She was an editor, regional editor of our news bulletin. She also edited the news from abroad section of the news bulletin, and later became our first female vice president in 1962 and our first president in 1963, first female president in 1963. So we have her prominently displayed here, including some insightful letters that she wrote to the executive committee of the society at various times, trying to get them to think about what an international society should look like with respect to simple things like editing the news bulletin so that non-English speakers would have greater ease of understanding what we're talking about, avoiding abbreviations and colloquial slang. And when we cited European literature, to remember to do things like include diacriticals on the letters so that people would actually know what the words meant, because we have a letter that we posted where she indicates that different diacriticals on the same letters actually yield different meanings in the words in French. And so she was very, very interested in maintaining people's focus on the fact that if this is going to be an international society, we have to play by international rules. So we have that on there. And then the society, of course, had formed in 1940. We had our first annual meeting in 1941, and then the United States entered World War II. So there were no meetings held in during the war years. So in 1942, 1943, and 1944, the meetings of the SVP were canceled, and only the officers of the society met to conduct society business, which was required by our charter that they meet annually to do basic business. So only the officers met during that time. And the decision to do that really was expressed very nicely in a letter written by George Gaylord Simpson in September of 1942, in which he said an SVP meeting cannot have any really vital war function. And Ottawa, which is where they were considering having the meeting, is definitely a defense area, and so is almost any other place where good SVP attendance would be probable. From the point of view of the war effort, the travel of any of our members for the purpose of our meeting must be considered non-essential. It is also clear that a representative meeting will be impossible because many members are in armed forces or doing war work for which they cannot be spared, and even the others will find travel exceptionally difficult. It therefore seems to me that we should not hold a regular meeting, and I would be opposed to our doing so as both unpatriotic and impractical. So that's George Gaylord Simpson announcing why we're not going to hold meetings. And then we found in the archives of the Society a number of documents pertaining to the World War II and the activities of Society members who were in military service at the time. These include members who were wounded in combat or missing in action. We also have materials that were written by Society members back and forth to each other or to officers of the Society bringing up news about what they're doing overseas. And we found a very interesting notice, handwritten by George Gaylord Simpson, that was eventually published in the news bulletin. Right as the war is over, he writes an advertisement that we can now finally produce our prospecting picks again, and that we can use metal again and produce picks for the field. And so we provided a photograph of that. And again, that's tied to the logo, because the prospecting pick, what we call a marsh pick, is very prominently displayed on the logo of the Society. So the logo of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology was drafted by Margaret Colbert shortly after the Society was formed. And she used her husband Ned Colbert's marsh pick, which is a sort of a very slimmed down, lightweight version of a pickmatic. It's handheld. It's not a two-handed thing. It's a one-handed piece. And sitting in front of it is a section of the vertebral column of Eriops, a famous North American Paleozoic tetrapod. And behind the two of those is a circle that we think, we interpret this as being symbolic of the unification of all the practitioners of vertebrate paleontology, the importance of field work, going in the field, the marsh pick represents that, the importance of fossils, the collection, which is represented by the vertebral column of Eriops. And there's also some subtle things about the logo that we think are, we can read symbolism into it, whether she intended it or not, because the Eriops vertebral column was described by Edie Cope, and the marsh pick is named after O.C. Marsh, and these are the two paleontologists in North America famous for the Bone Wars fiasco that demonstrates the nastiness that can emerge from antagonistic behavior in the sciences. And so the fact that she's drawn a circle around them, a harmonious circle, is, I think, symbolic of the fact that she's pleading for that kind of behavior to stop. And, so we featured the logo prominently through our exhibits here today. We provided also insight for our membership onto just some of the basic business activities of the Society in the past. We provided a list of all the places that we've met as a Society since the inaugural meeting in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And, we've had, of course, 75 years now as a Society. Three of our meetings were canceled because of the war, but the others have been held all over the North American continent. We've gone internationally several times to Mexico and also to Canada. And we left the North American continent for the first time for a meeting in Bristol, England, and then we've also met in Berlin. So we're hoping that this is a trend that will continue. Every several years, we'll go off the North American continent and truly try, in an effort to really try to truly establish the SVP as an international society. And those meetings have been fantastic. I attended both the Bristol and the Berlin meetings, and they were great because we meet European colleagues. We see European colleagues that we don't normally get to see in North America, and we meet their students, and that's really been fantastic in terms of cross-fertilization of ideas and things of this nature, so it's been great. Then we have a list of the past presidents of the Society. We also found a napkin in the archives of the Society, demonstrating that important things really do happen on the back of napkins. It's a list of potential officers who will be holding their candidate slate, sort of who's going to hold office in the Society in coming years, and it's just this list of 10 people. We think it was drawn up at a meeting sometime around 1955. And that was kind of a fun discovery. And we've also documented a little bit of the history of SVP establishing a relationship with the Smithsonian Institution to archive our materials. And those archives now are actually quite extensive. They were started in 1988. There was an agreement signed between the Society and the Smithsonian to house the archival materials of the SVP. And the archive committee spent 2 weeks in Washington, D.C. reviewing the contents of the archive and discovering what was there and what was not there. And there's a wealth of material from the early years of the Society in terms of correspondence and, of course, the establishment documents and all of these kinds of things. And we also found things that were missing from the archives, and we're now actively trying to fill holes. So one of the things we've been doing at this meeting is talking to people who we know are pack rats who never throw things away, and we're talking to them about giving us materials to put in the archives, and we're hoping we're going to get some success with that. And we've also asked members here at this meeting, one of the things we've displayed at the meeting here is a series of photographs of earlier meetings of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology that are back in the old days when we weren't an enormous, huge society. We would have the opportunity to have everybody move outside and gather for a group photograph. And these are a lot of fun to look at. We found photographs in the archives of the 8th annual meeting of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology held in New York City. We also found the 1954 meeting photograph that was held in Los Angeles, another meeting in Los Angeles in 1977, and the SVP meeting, the 31st annual meeting held in Washington, D.C. And we put these group photos up so that people could look at them and see who was at the meetings those years. And they're fun photographs. And the society now is so large that we really can't do that anymore. So instead, we've posted a series of posters around the building during the meeting asking everybody to take selfies and send them into an email address where we're going to compile them and build essentially a digital photographic collage of all the attendees of the meeting. And we've promised that we're going to put them in the archives, and we're not going to use them against anybody in any nasty way, but instead we'll compile them for another exhibit at our 100th anniversary meeting, and that'll be the first time that those are made public. And I've discovered, unfortunately, that there are many people here, especially our older members, who have decided that they're not going to do a selfie, and there's other recalcitrant young members who also decided that they're not going to do a selfie. And so several of us have been running around. I've been taking belfies. As Chris Bell, I can go in and take a selfie on their behalf. So I've been photographing people, and as have my colleagues, in an effort to try and do a good job documenting who's actually here at the meeting. And we've also presented discussions on the posters about the publications of the Society, all the different things that the Society has produced as formal publications over the years. And most importantly, these are things that some of our younger members either are not aware of, or they don't know, I mean, they don't know about them at all, or they have only a minimal familiarity with these things. One of those is the News Bulletin. And the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology News Bulletin in the early years of the Society was the voice of the Society, and it was the glue that held everybody together. And that's really clear when you read some of the letters and correspondence that are housed in the archives at the SVP. It's very clear that the News Bulletin was the thing that held everybody together and gave them a sense of self and a sense of society. And the people now, younger people now, have a tendency to think of the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology, or the JVP, as the voice of the Society. And that's our official outlet for published research of Society members. But that didn't get started until 1981. So until then, there was no JVP, and it was the News Bulletin. And the other document that was really early in our history that was very important was the Bibliography of Fossil Vertebrates. And the BFV, as it came to be known, was another source of great information for Society members who were trying to keep track with an ever-expanding literature in multiple languages. It was really global in extent and very difficult to trace. And the SVP News Bulletins, and in the early years, carried bibliographic references, and eventually they decided to try to compile these into organized sources of formally published bibliographies. And there were two series that were started very early on. One was done by the Geological Society of America, and there were a series of these that were released as special papers under the title Bibliography of Fossil Vertebrates. And then there was another independent series that was started and sponsored and published by the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. There was a bibliography of references that were received by the Osborne Library at the American Museum of Natural History. And that project started by compiling references from 1945, 1946, and that was published in 1947. And that series continued into the early 1970s and was run through the Osborne Library for a while and later moved to the Yale Peabody Museum in New Haven, Connecticut. And then the other BFV series, the GSA one, started, the first ones were published, I believe, in 1940, and then it went through a series of transformations. It died, it was rejuvenated, and died again, rejuvenated. And finally, it was finished up. The Society took over publication itself in 1984 and continued the series until the 1992 volume, so the volume that covered references up to 1992, which was published in 1995. And then the Society cut funding for the BFE. And one of our members at the time, Don Baird, actually funded by himself the production of a final volume to cover 1993 titles. And that was the last volume of the BFE that's published. And so a lot of our new student members have no idea that this is there, and it's a fantastic resource. Because I'm afraid that this erroneous view that it's all online persists widely among our young members, and it's not all online. And the BFE then remains a really valuable resource for serious scholars who are trying to dive into a very complicated literature. And the people who put together the BFE in its closing years, Joe Gregory, Judy Backside, George Skirkin, and Bonnie Rauscher, were really phenomenal with foreign languages and managed to capture the literature of the world and put it into a readily accessible, digestible format for our members to use. So I hated to see the bibliography die. I still use it regularly, and I think serious scholars do too. And you can take that implication in any direction you want with respect to other people. Another aspect of the history of the publications of the Society that we felt was important to communicate to some of our younger members, and as a reminder to some of our older members, is just the way the Society used to deal with formal publications of our activities and announcements of upcoming meetings. So one of the things that has always been a special focus of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology is field conferences and field trips that are associated with our annual meetings. And in most cases, those trips or conferences were accompanied by special publications tied to a particular field trip or group of field trips that were guidebooks to the activities that were going to happen, introductions to the geology and vertebrate paleontology, the regions where people were visiting on the field trips. And these publications, in many cases, were printed for the members of the Society who were attending the trip, and there weren't other copies made or produced or distributed, and so there are very limited numbers of these things. One of the things we're trying to find now is how many of these field trip guidebooks were produced early on, how many people might have attended, and we're desperately trying to find copies of these to put in the Society archive. We've tried to provide visual images of some of the covers of these field trip guidebooks that we do know about and that are in the archives, and put a call out to the Society indicating that these are poorly represented and that we really would like to have people contact us if they have copies of field trip guidebooks so that we can build a set to put into the archive. And then we've also done the same thing with the meeting circulars. So now all meeting announcements now are transmitted by email, and those communications are entirely digital. But in the days before we communicated in that format, we sent circulars, actually paper copies of meeting announcements that went out twice. It was a first circular and a second circular that contained information about the meeting and what was going to happen in the events. And those, again, that's another aspect of the Society history that's very poorly represented in the documentation in the archive. So we're trying to capture those and the programs of the meetings so that the speaker schedules and things like that. So we've reminded people a little bit about that, and we've also, just again for the young people in the Society who don't know the history of it, our abstract volumes now are published exclusively online, and people are available to be downloaded as PDFs, or you can go to certain websites and have them printed if you want a print copy. But that was actually a long process getting to the point where our abstracts would be published. And the abstracts as a Society used to be delivered just in little, either briefly in the programs or not at all. And they simply had a list of talks and titles and who was going to speak. And one of our members who later became a president of the Society, David Krause, wrote a very interesting proposal to have the abstracts published and justified why that would be an important thing to do, and laid out an argument. And the Society membership voted on it. In the end, they decided to publish abstracts as formal supplements to the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology. So the first abstracts of the meetings were published in 1987. And that continued as a standard practice until 2010. And in 2010, printing and distribution were terminated, and the abstracts were made available only online. And in 2011, at the 2011 meeting, this was reestablished, the abstracts were reestablished as a supplement, this time to the online Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology. There were enough members who were upset that abstracts were no longer citable forms of communication, citable in the literature, that they decided to create them again as a formal supplement. So we've documented that here, and we've also talked a little bit about also talked a little bit about, on our banners here, the posters, talked a little bit about the transformations in technology that have had an impact on our field. And of course, the standard tools that we've always used in vertebrate paleontology, picks and shovels and paintbrushes and dental picks, all the things you see in movies that paleontologists cleaning fossils in the field, and then the preparation techniques that we've used in the lab to remove fossils from the rock or sediment that encases them. Those technologies haven't gone away. We still do that. But we have new tools to play with that give us new insights into working with vertebrate fossils and understanding what those fossils can tell us about paleobiology of ancient organisms. And one of the most prominent of those technologies that really has become almost omnipresent at our meetings now is the use of computed tomography, CT technology, which is a non-destructive way of visualizing in three dimensions on the computer the morphology of vertebrate fossils. And these technologies have transformed the way we think about, visualize, and image our fossils. And it's been really transformative work. And the application of that technology to vertebrate fossils dates back to 1984, and it penetrated the society in 1991, or the first paper in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology to use, the first authors to use CT data and publish them in the journal was in 1991. And now it's very common, and we see it everywhere. So we talked a little bit about how technology is changing our perspective. And the society has struggled a little bit, actually, with digital publication. We have released a number of publications that were part of our memoirs series, and we released some as CD-ROM. So the memoirs came with CD-ROM data dealing with CT computer tomography imagery. And it's a bit of a struggle now because it actually came up at our business meeting this year that these CDs no longer work on many platforms. So the membership now who are interested in the data that were communicated in that format no longer can access those data easily, and that's a challenge and a problem. And so one of the things that the archive committee is struggling now to deal with in collaboration with the publications committee and the communications committee is how to capture these digital data and archive them in a format that's a little more permanent, where we get carry forward on the technology so that people can continue to access those data. The final project that we put together for the meeting was a flip book that is essentially a 3-ring binder with sheets in it that include a photograph of one of our colleagues who's now dead, and behind the photograph are a page or a series of pages of an obituary that was written about that person and published in the pages of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology News Bulletin. And I put this together, actually, it was inspired by a conversation with my graduate students last semester who not complained, but pointed out that I talk a lot, with great familiarity, about various aspects of the history of the society and practitioners of vertebrate paleontology, and that they felt left out because they don't really know who these people were. And so we did a readings project and just picked some entertaining paleontologists from the past, people who were influential and people who were not so influential but led interesting lives or careers. And we looked for photographs of those people and biographies or obituaries and read papers that they had written. And this formed the center of our lab group discussion for an entire semester. And it got me thinking about the fact that a lot of younger people might know names from reading certain papers or because some of our society awards are named after certain people, but they might not know who those people really were, what they did in their career, or that they worked on a variety of things. So some people might know somebody because of work that they did on mammals, but they might not realize that they also worked on lizards or dinosaurs or something else. And so I thought that it would be interesting and relevant for the 75th anniversary meeting to have these people present at our meeting, bring back some of our colleagues who are no longer with us, so these students can't meet them face-to-face, but they can at least see their faces and read about them and learn a little bit about who they were and what they did. So we put together a flipbook initially of 50 people to do this. And then I realized, the meeting's being held in Texas, and there's two famous Texas paleontologists who were never written about in the news bulletin. They didn't receive obituaries. So I added them in. So we have 52 people represented in the flipbook for people to use. And it's gratifying to see that both young people are going through struggling to figure out who these people were and recognizing faces and putting faces to names, and also that some of our older members are going through and reminiscing about who these people were and what they did and telling funny anecdotal stories. And it brings those people back to a society of a paleontology meeting in a unique way that I think is kind of special for a 75th anniversary.
Will the flipbook be digitized?
Well, the eventual goal will be to put something like the flipbook not only in the archives, but make it digitally available on the Society website. The stumbling block on that is that we have to obtain copyright permission for all of the photographs. We can present them here as a one-time fair use issue, but to actually publicly make them available, I'll need to get copyright clearance. The photographs that are in the archive itself are fine because they belong to the Society and we can utilize them in that way. Other ones, not so much, and I'll need to get permission from families or from publications before we can do that.
Can the public access the archives?
The archives are accessible by the public. If you go to the Smithsonian Institution Archives website and do a search for the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, you will receive links as a return to all of the archives of the Society, plus all of the other archives that the Smithsonian Institution houses that include the words Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, in them. And that will include the files, correspondence files and business files of people who were at the Smithsonian Institution who were members of the Society. So C. Lewis Gazin and Charles Gilmore and people like that, their files are archived by the Smithsonian. You'll get hits on there too, but all you have to do is go to the website and look, and you can call up the materials are all entered into the archives by accession number. So you can look at individual accessions, and you click on an accession, and there's a brief description of it. And you click on it, and it'll open a page or a series of pages that document what that archive consists of. And some of them, you know, it'll say there's one document box of correspondence, and right now that's all we know. And so one of the things that the archive committee did in reviewing those archives is identify areas where the finding aids for archival materials need to be improved, so that members of the Society or members of the public can go in and look and say, you know, I'm really interested in correspondence between Al Romer and somebody else. You want to be able to search for Al Romer's name. And right now that wouldn't yield a whole lot, but our hope is to be able to adjust the finding aids so that they will. And other archives, you call up the accession, it says 20 boxes of material or 27 boxes. And you click on, and then those are organized by box. So you click on a box and it simply tells you the finding aids, for the most part, are whatever's written on the tabs of the file folders that are in that box. And so we're trying to improve that. But yes, they're publicly available. You have to make an appointment because the materials are stored actually off-site. They have a reading room in the archive for people to use materials. But they need to know that you need it, so they bring it and deliver it on-site for your visit. And they're open normal business hours, 9 to 5 on weekdays.
And do you think these will be digital someday?
Some of them already are. And the Society has digital materials that have been archived with the Smithsonian, and the Smithsonian welcomes digital archives moving ahead. So one of the things that we're definitely pushing for now is for people to scan photographic images and provide us the data that go with those, and we will upload them into the archives as digital documents. The Smithsonian Institution is getting ready to, getting ready to capture our entire website, because we're getting ready to change our website. And they will actually archive all the versions of our website as we move forward. So they do digital as well as hard copy archives.